The story is about how passion is connected to vision and business. As a business professor, that really excites me. I would like to introduce to you our Dean of the School of Business and Leadership, Dr. Dan Meshavi.
Welcome, everyone. On behalf of Dominican University's Leadership Lecture Series, in partner with Book Passage, it's my pleasure to welcome you to the institution this evening. This is sponsored by the Institute for Leadership Studies, which is part of the business school and is designed to really engage students, the campus, and the community in socially relevant discussions. I want to thank tonight's sponsors, Private Ocean, which is our gold sponsor, and I also want to thank our silver sponsors, Bank of Marin, Dominican's Women Leadership and Philanthropy Council, and the Marin Women's Commission. It is now my pleasure to introduce Russ Colombo, president of Bank of Marin, who will introduce our special guest this evening.
Thank you, Dan. Wow, how did I get so lucky to introduce the illustrious speakers tonight? It could have something to do with the fact that we're a sponsor. Maybe that's it. In 1978, Ina Garten left her job as a policy analyst in the White House to pursue her dream of owning a specialty food store. This store, named the Barefoot Contessa, eventually led the Food Network to her door, and today she is one of the country's most beloved culinary icons. Besides starring in and hosting her own show, she is the author of 7 best-selling cookbooks and a frequent contributor to major national publications, including a popular column in O Magazine. She also won an Emmy Award for Outstanding Lifestyle Culinary Host in 2009. Ina will be joined on stage by a woman who describes herself as a geek, but shares Ina's passion for cooking and sharing good food. Named one of the world's most powerful women by Forbes magazine, she is Marissa Mayer, best known as the new CEO, president, and director of Yahoo, and new mother to her 6-week-old son, McAllister. Please join me in welcoming this dynamic duo to the stage to talk life, resumes, and recipes. I'm thrilled to present Ina Garten and Marissa Mayer.
So first, we have to straighten it out a little bit. We had a little confusion because Marissa Mayer is actually interviewing me, but she's stuck in the road. She's late, and she's the head of Yahoo. And I was very happy to say that my dear friend Moira Forbes, who's the publisher of Forbes Women, just happened to be with me. So, and she's interviewed everybody from Oprah on down. So Moira has agreed to start the interview, and Marissa's going to come later and pick it up from there.
Well, I like Marissa, I was a geek, but unlike her, I didn't have the extraordinary engineering background, so, and I did not have a child 6 weeks ago. But I still have dark circles under my eyes for other reasons. Well, this is an extraordinary opportunity for me personally, because like all of you, Ina is an extraordinary entrepreneur. She's an extraordinary friend to us in the way that she's able to come into our homes and transform our lives in so many ways. And she's one of the most authentic, kind people I've ever had the chance to know. And I think that's why all of us are here today. When you were being introduced, we got a little bit of a snapshot into your career trajectory, and a little bit unexpected for a lot of people who know you in the kitchen in their homes. So if we were to rewind the tape, let's look at you back in college. What did you want to be when you grew up?
That's it. I actually didn't think I wanted to be anything. I remember there was a moment when I was first married when I was 20, and I remember there was a moment, I was still in college, and Jeffrey came home, and I was sitting on the sofa, and I was watching That Girl, if anybody remembers it, at 11 o'clock in the morning, and Jeffrey said to me, "You need to do something with your life." And I thought I was doing it. I was married. And he said, "You won't be happy unless you do something really interesting." And it was a moment that I thought he was the first feminist I'd ever known, that he really just believed that I should do something interesting. And it just completely changed my life.
How did you react when he said, "You should do something interesting with your life"?
It never even occurred to me. I just thought, you know, I'm sort of a certain age that women were, it was just the transition when women were starting to do things with their lives. And I was in college and I really didn't know what to do. And for the next 10 years, I sort of followed his lead. He was in the government, he worked for the Secretary of State, Kissinger, and for Vance. And so when we were in Washington, I got a job in the White House working on nuclear energy policy. I thought that's what I was supposed to do.
Which is an extraordinary juxtaposition from what you
do. Isn't that what everybody does?
What you do now. well, being the engineer or the, you know.
Well, I was always interested in science, which actually translates into food, but I was always interested in science, and so that's what I did. And then when I hit 30, and I think it's the moment in women of my age that sort of realized I don't want to grow up to be my husband. I was interested in very different things, and I thought, I really want to do something different. And I saw an ad for a business for sale in the New York Times, and it was a specialty food store in a place that I'd never been in the Hamptons. And I thought, oh my God, that's what I'd like to do.
Why specialty food?
Because I was always interested in cooking. When I was working in the White House, I used to give dinner parties every single weekend.
And
I
thought,
what?
How lucky were they?
Well, I don't know. Maybe they weren't that good then. I'm not sure. But we did have a very good time. And at some point, I thought, I spend my days doing something that's interesting, but not me. And at night, I did what I really love to do. And I thought, it's time to do that professionally.
So you bought the store.
So I saw this ad for a business for sale in the New York Times, and I kept thinking about it, and I came home, and I said to my husband, I really need to do something different. And he's the most supportive guy in the world. He's just unbelievable. And he said, you know, pick something you've always wanted to do. Pick something that's fun, and don't worry about whether you make money at it. He said, just if you pick something you really love to do, you'll be really good at it. And so I said, you know, I'd seen this ad for a business for sale, and maybe I should go look at it. And he said, let's go tomorrow. And I was just unbelievable. So we drove up to, it was in the Hamptons, and we drove up and looked at it. The whole store was the size of the stage. And I just thought, oh my God, this is what I want to do. So I made her a very low offer, thinking, we'll go home, we'll negotiate, I'll think about it. And she called me in my office the next day and said, thank you very much, I accept your offer. And I went, oh my God. I remember going to my boss's office and going, I think I just bought a business.
Well, good thing that you did. So you buy your business.
Yeah.
You open take the keys, open the door to your new store. Describe that first year for yourself where you have this extraordinary career jump, extraordinary reinvention. What was the biggest learning curve for you, and what surprised you most about yourself?
Everything. I remember the first weekend thinking this was the stupidest thing I had ever done in my life. I was working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It was incredible. I mean, I didn't know how to do anything. I'd never had an employee. I didn't know how to slice smoked salmon. I didn't know where you buy brie. I had no idea what to do.
I still don't know those things, so I can completely relate to that one.
I don't know how to run a magazine either, so... I just immersed myself in it, and I thought it was really interesting. I always saw this store as like a party, that if you come into the store, it should feel like you've come to a party. And so for me, it felt that way. It was like this big party, and everybody was having a great time, and I was the hostess. So
what did it surprise you? What surprised you most about yourself taking this jump to an entrepreneur? Were there things that you took a step back and say, wow, I never knew that was part of me?
That's so interesting. That's an interesting question, because I think what I all the way along the way, because I've made several career changes, is it terrifies me to make that kind of a change, to walk away from a job in the White House and just say, I'm going to try something I've never done before, and it just feels like jumping off a cliff. And I don't back off from being terrified.
Why? How?
I think if it doesn't keep me up at night, it's not worth doing. And it definitely keeps me up at night. So I surprise myself being willing to live with that terror.
Where do you think that came from? Because
I
think
know.
How many of us in the room sort of look at the word risk and look at a career change and think that may be really interesting, but have complete knots in the stomach. And it's hard to go from that dream to making that jump. Where do you think that came from?
I don't know if it's, I mean, I'm not, in some ways I'm self-confident that the decision I make is the one I want to make. It's right for me. And in some ways I'm not, and it's hard to sort out. I think we're all sort of confident in some areas and not confident in others. But I'm just willing to take that chance. And I don't like following somebody else's lead. I like making my own decisions. And if they're the right decision or they're not the right decision, it's my decision. And I don't have somebody telling me, you know, okay, at 10 o'clock you should do this and at 11 do that. I tend to run in the other direction. Not a good employee.
you have a few other strengths.
One of the things that I've learned along the way, all these decisions, is I think a lot of us think that we can stand on the side of the pond and figure out how the pond feels. And you really can't. You just got to jump in. And you splash around and you figure out what the temperature is and you just go, oh, this isn't the right pond, but there's a pond over there that's really interesting that I've learned about being in the pond. So I think that's what I've learned over the time, is that if you stand on the side of the pond, you actually never move. You're immobilized by it.
When you do jump into the pond and you do take on those experiences, setbacks are such an inevitable part of success. And I talked to so many leaders, so many extraordinary entrepreneurs like yourself, who say that failure has been the most defining moments and has fueled the qualities that have allowed them to succeed as a leader and as a business person. If you look at failure, as critical and as a critical learning experience, what has been your best failure?
Oh, it's interesting. I can't say that I've really sort of failed at something. It may be that I've gone in a direction and taken it somewhere else. But
or a learning curve where it fundamentally saw a crossroad and it either tested you or it developed a new skill that's been so critical to your growth and your success?
I think the thing that's happened to me more than like a failure that changed things is things have come to me that I've said, no, I can't possibly do that. And well, like doing television was like this. After I wrote a book and Food Network came to me and said, oh, you know, we really wanted to do a show, I thought I could never do it. I just don't have it in me to do it. I couldn't possibly do a television show.
What did you think someone who did a television show should look like?
What do I think?
What did
Nigella Lawson. Low cut, you know.
I love that.
And I don't look like that.
So
I think more, my trajectory has actually been more that people have asked me to do things that I just said, no, I'm not interested, or I couldn't do it, I wouldn't do it. And eventually I was convinced to try it, and it turned out better than I could have imagined. So I'm very reluctant to do things without knowing where they're going.
Before we get to that point where you started your TV success and you have been on this streak of bestsellers, which is easier to say than actually done to do, you are in the store, you build a cult following, you obviously develop as an entrepreneur and as someone who really understands how to connect and engage with people around food and around bringing people together. When did that store seem too small for you? When did you start to look at a new horizon?
Well, I do remember the moment I was helping a customer with like a pound of chicken salad and I started to cry. And I thought, I think it's time to do something else. I loved running the store. As I said, it was like a party. It eventually ended up being a 3,000 square foot store. It was a big store. And I loved running the store. But I, you know, at some point it was a little repetitive. I felt like I wasn't really growing. And a friend actually said to me, I kept thinking, what am I going to do next? What am I going to do next? And a friend who's very smart about business things said, type A people think that they can figure out what to do next while they're doing something, and they can't. What they need to do is just stop. So I thought, okay, let me try that. So I sold the store to two employees, the manager and the chef. And I built myself an office upstairs. And one day I was like baking 1,000 baguettes, and the next day I had nothing to do. I mean, really nothing. And I built an office upstairs, and I went to that office every morning at 9 o'clock, and I had nothing to do.
Was that scary for you?
It was the worst year of my life. It was just awful. Absolutely. I mean, I remember my husband, Jeffrey, I live in East Hampton, he is at Yale, so he would leave on Monday morning to go to Yale, and he would come back on Friday night, and he left one Monday morning, and I said to him, I have nothing to do all week. And he said, nothing, you must have something. And I said, well, I have a manicure on Wednesday, but that's it. I mean, I had nothing to do. But that was a really, you know, I tried a few ideas about what I was going to do with it, and I thought about a lot of things, and nothing really clicked. And finally, after about 9 months, he said, you know, you love the food business, stay in the game. Find something in the food business that would be interesting to do. And he's obviously he was the dean of the business school at Yale, so I very happily have the best business advisor. I thought, well, maybe I'll just write a cookbook, just have something to do tomorrow, never thinking that's what I was going to do.
Did you really envision it as just a cookbook, or was that just the next step for you?
I just envisioned it literally to have something to do tomorrow. I mean, it literally was that simple. It's like, oh my God, I could write a proposal for a book tomorrow. I'd have some, get up in the morning and have something to do tomorrow.
By the way, the crowd tomorrow, you're going to have 1,000 pages of new cookbooks tomorrow.
And then the next day, you know, I wrote the proposal and I gave it to an agent and she sent it to my dream publisher and they accepted it. And I went, oh my God, I have to write this book. And it just day after day, I thought, okay, I actually took the money from the advance, put it in a separate account because I was sure I was going to have to send it back because I wouldn't be able to write the book.
Well, let me ask you, we all think of a cookbook, different theme, but a collection of recipes, but there really is a larger vision and there's really a statement about who you are. What went into that first cookbook as a reflection of yourself as someone in the White House, as someone who ran a store? What did it say about you? What was that process like?
Well, I think that what I did was I wrote the cookbook that I wanted to have myself. And I think that made it very true to my own vision about what's important. And I'm basically, I like very simple food. And my experience at Barefoot Contessa, the specialty food store, was so different from other people's experiences that write cookbooks. Most people who write cookbooks have restaurants. And people eat differently, I realize now, at restaurants than they do at specialty food stores. When I first had the store, I would put out these, you know, like veal roast stuffed with morels. Nobody wanted it. And I realized what people wanted is roast chicken and roast carrots. That's how people eat at home. So I had that basis, and I like that kind of food. I like very simple, absolutely delicious sort of comfort food like that. And so writing the book that I wanted to have myself, which was quite different. At that time, this was 1997, the books that were really popular then were How to Cook Everything, Mark Bittman's book, which has, I don't know, like 500 recipes, or The Cake Bible, which is also 500 recipes, you know, just enormous, huge books. And I wanted a book that was a really edited book that had 75 really good recipes, which frankly is all anybody needs to have, with gorgeous photographs so that I know what it's supposed to look like. So I had a very clear vision of the book I wanted, and that's what I wrote. And I think that's why it feels true, because I wasn't doing it for any other purpose other than what I thought was a good cookbook.
You finish the last pages of your cookbook, goes to press, the magic world of publishing, comes back. What was the experience when you first held one of these cookbooks?
It was the great moment of my life. It was incredible. I remember my editor called me and said, are you going to be in New York? So, you know, can you come by? And I said, sure, I'll just drive by. I'll meet you on the street. He said, I have a little something for you. And he handed me my first cookbook, and it was extraordinary. Just extraordinary.
And the rest is history. No, there's far more in between that.
Well, then they get harder and harder because the bar gets higher.
Well, you're setting the bar for the industry.
I set the bar very high.
But when you do this extraordinary cookbook, it's also very different, though, when you start to have people engaging with something, engaging with your recipes, incredibly personal, engaging with you, which is very different than face-to-face at the store. What was that like for you to go from a business owner to really develop a brand where you're going into people's home, a very different relationship?
It is. It's interesting because what was surprised me about, I didn't know what to expect from the cookbook business. I just was writing a cookbook. I thought it would be really interesting. What surprised me is that people, it gave people the tools to do something for themselves rather than giving them something. And the response was so warm and so surprising to me and just so satisfying. I mean, so many people stop me in the street and say, I taught them how to cook. And for me, cooking, it's not just about the food. It's that when you cook, everybody shows up. For me, it's about the community. And if you cook, you have better food for your family. And it doesn't have to be fancy. It can be ingredients from a grocery store. You come home and make roast carrots and roast chicken. It's wonderful.
You've mentioned a couple of times giving people the tools. The tools to cook, the tools to bring people together. Where do you think you got those tools from? Who taught you? Where did you learn it?
I don't know. I think it was in my DNA. I think my mother cooked to have dinner on the table. It wasn't for her. It wasn't about community. My grandmother actually loved to entertain. She was always cooking. Whenever you went there, she was cooking. She loved to feed people. So I think probably that's in my DNA. Apparently, I'm quite like her. And she used to have a very good time.
Well, that is a good lineage to have. so you published the first cookbook. Now this is number 8, correct?
Yes, number 8.
Walk us through the steps along the way where your brand not only scaled, but you started to take the work that you were doing and translate it into new mediums to continue to push yourself. What was the next biggest jump for you in this journey?
Well, it was definitely television. I thought it was the cookbooks I thought were really important because you can it can explain to somebody how to make coconut cupcakes. So if you don't know, you know, you have a good recipe, here's a recipe that you know is going to work, it's going to be absolutely delicious, and your family's going to say, you made this yourself, which is so satisfying. but then I thought there are a lot of people that can't work with a printed page. They want to actually see it happen. So when Food Network came to me and asked me to do a TV show after saying no for year after year, and they finally went to London, found a production company I love, hired them, called me and said, they're coming to East Hampton next week. I was like, whoa. I realized that television would allow people to actually see it being made. So how you actually sift the flour, how you measure the flour, how you chop something, it's a much more visual process, which I'm much more visual. I realize that takes it to the next step. But television's a scary medium, you know, it's me and a camera. So that was a really hard thing to learn. I didn't have to learn to do it. I felt like I did it naturally, but it's a pretty scary process.
What was it like the first time you saw yourself on TV?
I never have. I think if I ever saw it, I'd never do it again.
Everyone, if you ever see Ida around the TV, shut it off.
That's right. If I'm around, just turn it off.
What? There's so many
it's
different
just very nice. I love how people feel about it. And what I love about TV, actually, is also the range. is I remember there was a day I was walking on Madison Avenue and a woman coming the other way in a big fur coat was like, oh, darling, I just love your cookbooks. And about a block later, a truck was going up the street and a truck driver leaned out and said, hey, baby, love your TV show. And I thought, what other medium could do that?
Yeah.
Great.
That is very true.
I love, everybody wants to be in a kitchen with somebody who's cooking for them, sitting on the other side of the counter and just hanging out with them. And I think half the people who watch the show don't cook. They just find it really pleasurable. Am I right? Is it everybody doesn't cook?
When I first met Ina, I had shoes in my oven. So, and I still watch.
You have shoes in your oven? I'm coming to your house to cook for you.
Well, I will take you up on that offer. But I still loved it. It's so comforting. But there's so many different shows about cooking. How to cook, do it in 10 seconds, Southern, French,
how to cook
5 hours,
seconds.
You're gaining 50 pounds, you lose 50 pounds. What, though, does your show say about you? How do you feel like it's differentiated in a way that's a reflection of who you are?
You know, a lot of people say, oh, I'd love to have a brand. You can't go out and have a brand. The only way you have a brand is if it's true to who you are. And that's reflected in everything you do. So I think I'm really very simple person. My tastes are simple. I'm interested in flavor and texture and how layers of flavor go together, that they're not complicated, that they're delicious and appealing. And when everybody sits down, they know exactly what it is. It's not like fish eyeballs and foam. And you go, ooh, what is that? I'm really about making people feel really comfortable and relaxed. And when there's the best BLT you've ever had on your plate, you go, God, that looks great. So that's what I'm about. And I think that really is reflected in everything I do. In, you know, simple, good ingredients and food that's just delicious.
So if you have those core attributes, that thread amongst all of these different books, we're still talking hundreds of recipes.
Many hundreds,
probably thousands. And when you actually edit them down into the ones that make it into the cookbook, where do you get your inspiration from? How do you start to come up with new ideas and new recipes that still adhere to these principles that may seem simple in theory, but in execution, they're not?
Well, it's a process. And actually, after the first book I thought, well, that was all the recipes I had from the store. So I thought, okay, that's it. That was really fun.
You're recipe'd out.
I have no more recipes. And the publisher, because it did very well, the publisher called and said, we need another book right away. I was like, whoa, I don't have any recipes. And then I thought, well, I did a lot of catering when I had a specialty food store. So I thought, well, I can use those, and that became Barefoot Contessa Parties, which is recipes that you use for entertaining. And then they were like, we need another one now. I thought, well, I just thought it was over. In the beginning, I found it very hard to come up with new ideas for recipes, but as time has gone on, I think it's probably like exercising a muscle. Now I could sit down and write 100 ideas for recipes that I want to test, which is what I do with every book.
When you're walking around, when you're traveling, are there certain things that stand out to you that tweak something in your mind, that give you inspiration? What are the things along the way that we may not know, come into this book and come into our homes?
One of the things I'm always interested in is a traditional recipe with a little twist. For example, like a pound cake. I mean, everybody has a pound cake. I always try and make the best pound cake I can possibly make. But there's something about it. There's one that I make that has a crystallized sugar on the outside of it. So it's got a little bit of a crunch to it, a little sweetness, but it's got vanilla, so it has sort of that depth of flavor. So I'm looking for a traditional recipe that is like better than you can imagine. It sort of pushes the envelope a little bit. And that comes from everywhere. It rarely actually comes from restaurants because those tend to be much more complicated flavors. It comes from going to somebody's house for dinner. It comes from going to a specialty food store.
Not coming to my house for dinner.
If I wanted baked shoes, I'd come to your house, yeah. Right?
When you look at your first cookbook and you look back at it, aside from the recipes, how is this one different from the first one, and having interacted with the millions of people who love you, what have you also learned about the audience that you're speaking to? Has this engagement also educated you as to?
Oh, absolutely, totally. One thing I've learned is I'm very conscious now of how person at home is using that printed page. And one thing I developed over the, you know, maybe after two books, is I have a process for a recipe that really informs it. One is I'll take somebody to the grocery store and give them a recipe and say, I'd like to see you shop for this recipe. And I took a friend of mine with a pesto recipe. And the first ingredient was basil. And he said, I don't know, is it like a dry thing or a fresh thing? Or where do you find basil in the grocery store? And I realized, and then we went to the olive oil section. And he said, I mean, you know what the olive oil section looks like? It's huge. So all of that will inform me. So I said to him, okay, you want extra virgin olive oil? This is what you're looking for. And he picked one out, and I realized that he had picked out an eight-ounce bottle of olive oil, and he didn't need a cup and a half. Well, all of a sudden, he's home, and he doesn't have enough olive oil. So he's completely frustrated. So it's from the start of a recipe, I really think through how somebody is going to use every single step in that recipe. So I think as time has gone on, one of the things I do is I hand my assistant, who's a good home cook, the printed page and say, make it. And I watch her make it. And we always have such a laugh because she does the craziest things that I would never have imagined. I mean, one of them was was great. She was making, I think it was cooked lentils. And the instructions say to take a turnip and put cloves in the turnip and cook it in the water with the lentils. And I was doing something else and sort of keeping an eye on her. And I look over and she's got this thing that looks like Sputnik. She's got it's like got a turnip and it's got skewers coming out of this thing. And I'm like, what is she doing? And she's got cloves of garlic on these things. And I said, no, not cloves of garlic, cloves. And so I wrote dried cloves in the ingredient list because somebody else is going to be confused by that. So I'm always looking for information about how people cook, how they shop, how they cook, that really informs the recipe. So you feel like I'm standing next to you going, no, don't worry, it's going to bubble up violently. That's what it's supposed to do.
You're like our trusted advisor.
Good.
Or crisis management for some of us who would do the garlic clove debacle, which is bringing back some memories for me about some similar experiences. I will not say here because there's 1,000 people, and well, I don't know you, so I guess I could tell you, but this is about I know. So all these different cookbooks, you now have a television show. I'm really interested about this concept of success because someone will look at you and say, incredibly successful person, and how we define success is very different, and it's often a moving target, changes over time. When did you, for the first time, take a step back and say, I'm really successful at this? Or did you ever think about
You're
it like that?
I have said that.
I was going to say, or did you ever think about it like that? Because it's always really interesting when you have the public perception, but it's very different when it's your personal life. What at least was it like for people to say, call you a success, you know, to call you a superstar? How do you deal with that?
I don't feel any differently than I did 20 years ago. I love that I get to do what I love to do, and I love that people enjoy it. And I don't, it doesn't feel different to me. I mean, it's wonderful to have everybody come and hear us talk, but I don't feel, as a person, I don't feel any differently.
How do you define success?
That I get up in the morning and I just say, what do I feel like doing today? And what I feel like doing is testing a recipe. And that's what I get to do. That to me is about as successful as you can get, is that I have a wonderful husband, I live in a place I love, I have great friends, and I get to do professionally what I love to do. So
what?
It's pretty great.
if you're continuing though to push yourself, to push the boundaries, go into television, keep doing these books, What is that? What do you think that trajectory looks like?
Well, it's funny because I really don't. I never plan for the future. I just I love that I love what I do right now. I love that, I always feel if I can just keep what I'm doing now, continue it, I'll be very happy. And then, you know, things come along and people ask me to do crazy things. And, you know, I mean, somebody asked me to endorse their line of fertilizer. I'm like, what?
And the whole chain of things, that's where you got the turnip, so.
I mean, so I get asked all these crazy things. And every once in a while, something comes along and I go, that actually might be kind of interesting. So I sort of wait to see what the universe, how the universe reveals itself. But right now, I feel like I'm doing exactly what I want to do, and I'd be very happy to keep doing it.
With that dynamism in what you do, if someone asked you to give a job description of what you do, what would your job description, would your job title be too?
I think it would be like chief bottle washer and street sweeper. I mean, one of the things I love is I think people think I have this enormous organization around me. It's basically three of us.
No
illusion. not a big organization. I like that I'm involved in every single detail of what I do. When I do a book, I do every recipe myself. I do the design of the book myself. I do I have an incredible team of photographers, food stylists, but I'm involved in every photograph. I mean, every font, every color, I really choose myself. And I find that really satisfying. And I think if it gets too big and you're involved in too many things, you can't do that. And so I would lose what I find really satisfying about my business.
If you were to look back at yourself of 25 years ago, write yourself a letter 25 years ago, what would it be the piece of advice you would have said to Ina of, I guess, 25, is that 80s, 90s? I can't do the math. 25 years ago, I can't do the math what year, but yeah. Called 30 years ago. Yeah. What would be the one piece of advice you would have given to yourself then?
It'll turn out all right. I mean, I remember when I bought Barefoot Contessa and I thought, oh my God, what have I done? I left a perfectly good career to do this crazy thing. It's just so nice to know that it turned out okay. I did exactly what I needed to do, and I'm really glad I did it.
What keeps you up at night now?
How am I ever going to do the next book? Because I set the bar so high.
Do you see that as a treadmill? Some would say
no,
you've accomplished so much, but you know, it seems like it's not a definitive, you know, definitive point that this passion, this ambition is ongoing.
I learn something from every book, and I find each book has a backstory that I think is really interesting to explore. As this one is, it's really about how to make a recipe foolproof so you know it's going to come out perfectly every single time. And each book has a different point of view that I think is worth exploring.
So let's talk about this book.
I haven't gotten bored yet.
No, well, neither have we. Let's talk about this book, though, because we're all really excited about it. What does foolproof mean to you? You said that earlier, simple, easy, idiot-proof. Why foolproof for you, and why was that so important for you to start to dig deeper here?
Well, I'm so interested in how people use recipes and how they're, as I said, what their experience. I mean, in you know, people call it the user experience. Is Marissa here?
Yes. Oh, there she is.
How are you? Don't be silly.
Hello. How are you?
This is Maura.
And nice to see you.
Thank you so much. Will you join
us? Sorry,
I'm
so late.
Marissa Maya.
This is the other Marissa
Mayer. That's great.
I felt so honored that I got your bio as an introduction.
Baby 6 weeks ago.
Yeah, and then I'm an engineer, and then I actually cook. So this has been a pretty good night for me.
Thank you so much. Oh, I'm so happy to be here. I'm so glad Maura was here too.
No. Well, I'll hand it over to you, and I'll just say before I do that, what's really extraordinary about being here with these two women is the fact that we often talk about success and leadership and you know, five tips to be successful or five tips to make life easier. And so often these things mean very little in the abstract. And it's through the narratives and experiences of others that I think are the most powerful lessons. And these two women, I think, can be some of the most extraordinary teachers, not just in the work that they do, or Ina, for example, making sure that I don't blow up my oven, but also teaching us in navigating life's experiences, making those huge risks, both of you, career reinvention.
Well, Marissa, much more than I.
Well, you kept us fed along the way, so, but these extraordinary career journeys. So I really, would say to you all, these women have so much to learn from, and their stories are extraordinary. So I think you have one of the most amazing dynamics between the two of them. And with that, I will leave it to the real Marissa Mayer.
I absolutely don't want to interrupt the conversation, so I want to make sure that please feel free to jump in. And I just want to say that that's one of the reasons why I was so excited to be here tonight and interview Ina, because I've learned so much from her.
Thank you.
We've known each other for about 2 years now, and I will just say that, you know, I've learned many, many different things, and I just think you've got an amazingly inspiring journey. And the parallels between what Ina does and what I get to do are actually like pretty profound in terms of putting yourself in
the
place of
the
user.
Can I just say how flattered I am? I'm even in their company.
and really innovation, and how do you add a certain flair, and how do you appeal to a user, and how do you add something a little special from yourself? So I'm really excited because I've just found a huge amount of inspiration from you and learned so much from you. So Maura really nailed it for me, because that's one of the best parts that I've had in our friendship.
And one of the things Marissa and I always talk about is the user experience, which is the way you just talk about it with Google and Yahoo, which is wonderful.
Yeah.
Is how people experience what we do, which is so important.
And so I like to start off, even though it embarrasses Ina a little bit every time, in terms of how I met her, because I'll be honest, not being someone who cooks a lot myself, like I like to bake from time to time, but I've always been lucky to be at companies with free food, so I haven't had to cook very much. And where they haven't had free food, I've made the food free.
So as a result, I hadn't met Ina, I didn't know her,
and we were at a luncheon where one of the guests of honors was Gail King, who had invited Oprah to introduce her. So of course, the whole luncheon was all a flutter with the fact that Oprah was there. And the first moment I laid eyes on Oprah, who had just come into the room, I watched her get shoved out of the way with someone saying, "Oh my God, Ina!"
They obviously didn't know who Oprah was.
And so I immediately said, I need to know who Ina is. And of course, now that I do, I completely understand.
That was quite a lunch.
But, you know, your story is tremendous, because as I even found out that day, you started off doing nuclear energy policy at the White House, which I don't know how many people here knew that.
That's a normal succession.
I don't know if you touched on this earlier or not, the path to becoming Barefoot Contessa. And I just think there's just so many amazing turns along the way in terms of advice. And so if you haven't had a chance to talk about that tonight, I would hope you would.
We did a little bit, but one of the things that I think interesting is the connection from science.
Yeah.
Is that people always ask me, what did I learn from my job as a nuclear policy analyst to running a specialty food store? And the truth is probably nothing, but both of them have an interest in science for me. I mean, they're really, except that one you end up with like enriched uranium, and the other one you end up with pound cake. And I'm much happier with a pound cake. So I think that was the path that I mean, you're always interested in science as well.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think the other piece of it that is that you've been really you've been a huge innovator.
Thanks.
And I think that the layout of your kitchen we've talked about in terms of how do you think about how you can relate to people who are using your cookbooks in terms of, you know, how do you find the inspiration for it, but also how do you make sure that this is something that's feasible for people? And so I thought maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, I think one of the things about cooking is that I'm not a trained professional chef, which one would think would really work against me writing cookbooks. But the truth is, I think it's worked for me. I certainly didn't do this deliberately, but it's worked out. Is that I find cooking really hard. I don't find it something that, I mean, I always have this vision of Bobby Flay, you know, like touching the steak and saying, oh, it's medium rare, or, you know. Somebody who's worked on the line who really has, like, cooked professionally all day, every day on a line, really has a different sense of cooking, or, you know, gone to French Culinary Institute. I really learned by teaching myself, and I started literally with Julia Child's Mastering the Art of French Cooking and worked through that those two books. So I find cooking really hard, and so I relate to somebody who's trying to make dinner and have, you know, you have to make three, you can't make just one thing, you have to make three things for dinner. And organizing that and getting it on the table hot is hard. And so I think that I make my recipes really simple so I can do it. And I think that makes it easier for everybody else.
How do you put together a dinner party? So when you've got three or four things on the table, what's your process?
Well, you know, usually a couple of days before, the first thing I do is make a menu. And I figure out, like, what does everybody eat? Because I'm not going to make one vegetarian thing, one thing for people who don't eat fish. I like to make just one menu, because otherwise you can really drive yourself crazy. So if there's somebody vegetarian, there'll be a main course, like a fish or meat or something, and two or three vegetables. So I figure out what the simplest menu is, and then I start crossing things off. Do we really need 62 different vegetables? And do we have to have a first course? No. I try and simplify, and then I look at the menu and say, can I make this menu with the equipment that I have? So, I mean, do you need three ovens and 16 pots? And you really have to think through, because you don't want to get to the end and say, it's Tuesday, people are coming in an hour, and oh my God, I forgot to soak the beans. Or I have to have three things in the oven at three different temperatures, and I only have one oven. So it's it's really a very scientific process to try and figure out how to do it. And then when it comes to actually dinner, people are shocked that I have a schedule. I mean, it literally says 5 o'clock, turn the oven to 350 degrees. 5:15, put the carrots in. Because it's a very complicated process, and if I don't write it down, I always forget what to do.
And I also think it's interesting to think about the role that practice plays in all of this, in terms of, should you have made the recipe before or not? Right? We talked a little bit about this.
How many people, I mean, I don't know how many of you have done this, you see a recipe in Gourmet Magazine or something, or, you know, Food and Wine, and you go, that looks amazing. I think I'll make it on Saturday night for 12 people. Is that a good idea? I have to admit, I never, ever make something for company that I haven't made at least once before. And in fact, I never make dinner for Jeffrey with something that I haven't made before, because I have no idea how it's gonna turn out. So I think practice is really important. And that's actually one of the things about foolproof is, I like to take a recipe that I've made and do a variation on it. Because if you know how to make chicken pot pie, you can do a variation on that, make seafood pot pie or vegetable pot pie. And once you have the process down, it's so much easier to do a variation on it. I mean, in this book I have, there's a classic Barefoot Contessa brownie recipe that's really good. And I thought, I'm gonna make it into salted caramel brownies, which is particularly good. And so it's the same recipe. I feel totally comfortable making the brownies, and doing a variation is not as stressful as doing a completely different recipe. So.
And where do you get your ideas from? So how do you decide to make them salted caramel brownies? And how do you decide what recipes go in?
Well, that's a good example, actually. Do any of you know France salted caramels? They're amazing. They're these caramels that are wrapped in chocolate and have sea salt on them. And I thought, why can't I do the brownies like that? So I get inspiration from all different places. And Marissa and I talk about this a lot. You have to get out of your own way. You can't sit at home and figure out what to do. You have to get out there. I travel a lot. I see a lot of things. I talk to a lot of people. I ask, you know, if I... I spent a little time in France, and you'll see somebody at the market with a table with just raspberries on the table. They grew those raspberries, and I love to go and say, what do you do with those raspberries? I mean, I have a million things I know to do with raspberries, but they always come up with an incredible idea that never occurred to me. So you just get inspiration from talking to people and just opening yourself to ideas.
What are some of your favorite meals and recipes that are inside of Foolproof?
So many. One of them that I've made a lot is actually slow roasted filet of beef with basil parmesan mayonnaise. And I love it because, and as opposed to a high temperature filet of beef, which gets sort of cooked on the outside and very rare on the inside, this is done at a lower temperature and it's perfectly cooked all the way through. It takes about an hour and 15 minutes and you can't screw it up. It's just, it comes out perfectly every time. Even Maura can't screw it up. But first you have to take the shoes out of your oven.
Be careful making such a definitive statement. Because there are always the exceptions. So.
And the basil parmesan mayonnaise, you can make it a day ahead and just leave it in the refrigerator. And there's another one that I've actually made a lot, which is a potato and celery puree, which you can make a little ahead and then reheat, and then with seared scallops. And it has a basil oil drizzle on it. And if you really want, like for New Year's Eve, I like to do it with white truffles, which is particularly fabulous.
So speaking of New Year's Eve, Thanksgiving is coming up.
Yeah.
How do you celebrate Thanksgiving? Do you host big groups of people? And also, what kinds of things do you like to put on the table?
Well, Thanksgiving, I don't know how everybody feels about Thanksgiving, but it's like a traditional thing. You always want to have certain things on the table, but I like to, just the way, it's a classic thing, but maybe with a little twist to it. So I always have turkey, but people get so obsessed with the turkey. I mean, they fry it in oil and they brine it for 6 weeks, and it's to make themselves crazy. A turkey is really just like a large chicken. Butter, a salt and pepper, put it in the oven, you're done with it. I mean, brining, what I like to do is I like to salt it actually in advance. So instead of brining in a big pot of water, and you have to take all the shelves out of your refrigerator in order to put the big pot of water in, all you have to do is just salt it a day or two in advance, and it really gets into the turkey. But the star of the meal, I think, really is the vegetables. So I love to make their roasted Brussels sprouts with a balsamic vinegar on them. There's haricot vert with lemon zest and pine nuts. And I just love lots of really wonderful autumn vegetables, butternut squash.
And you have a newfound opinion on stuffing.
Stuffing. Do you want to talk about stuffing? I hate stuffing. Actually, the thing about stuffing is there are two things about it. One is, and everybody says, don't stuff the turkey and then put it in the fridge, because it's so bad for you. Stuffing, when it's in the turkey, it just gets soggy, and I just think it has no flavor. The other thing is the turkey has to cook for a really long time. So what I do is I cook a turkey with no stuffing so the heat gets into the center of it. It cooks in much less time. The turkey's much moister, trust me. And then what I do is I have a mushroom and leek bread pudding, which is like stuffing, but it's baked in a pan. And it's crusty on the top, and it's just moist and delicious on the inside. And so you've got turkey and stuffing without all the hassle. And it's so much better, trust me.
So for a novice cook like me, are there places, the recipes that you think are good to learn on and try out first, especially in the foolproof method?
I think one of the things about the recipes is if you just go step by step and just follow exactly what to do, I think everything will turn out perfectly. even like pie crust, there's a lot of people who are nervous about pie crust and Thanksgiving so much about pies. But if you go step by step, and it's just really important that there's butter throughout the crust. You can see little pieces of butter in it, that you don't overmix it, and you roll it out, and you don't stretch it into the pan. What you want to do is ease it into the pan. And all that's in the recipe. I think anybody can make a pie.
So that brings me to the topic of crust. Because
crust,
one of the most interesting things that happened is I was lucky enough to get to visit Ina in the Hamptons, and she made the most divine coffee cake.
Thank you.
And what I loved about it was that there was this granular sugar in the crust.
We were actually talking about this.
Amazing flair, which is, I found very innovative. It was like just a really, really well done coffee cake, but had this amazing extra touch to it. How do you do that? I mean, if you already explained it, we can.
Oh, how physically to do it?
Yeah. How do you get that grainy sugarness in the crust?
Well, first what you do is you start with demerara. We were talking about this earlier because it's really taking a traditional recipe and just doing something really unique with it, but sort of making it even better. What you do is you take, it's made in a two pan, and what I do is I butter the inside of the pan and then take demerara sugar, which doesn't dissolve as easily, and then I dust the inside of it with demerara sugar and it stays on the inside, and then pour the batter into it and it just bakes on the top, so you get this really nice crunch when you taste it.
It was absolutely,
thank you,
absolutely delicious.
Oh, great.
I think that one of the really things I found very inspiring from you is you have this perspective on advice. Jeffrey's given you good advice along the year.
So many
of your friends have. What's the best piece of advice you've ever gotten?
The best piece of advice? I think the best piece of advice I've ever gotten was from Jeffrey, is do what you love, and if you love it, you'll be really good at it. And I think that's great advice for anybody, because I don't have to push myself to work. I don't feel like I'm working. I feel like I'm just having a ball. If I hate doing things I don't like doing, and I'll do everything. I'm such a procrastinator. If I don't want to do it, I just will never do it. I'll do a million other things on the way there. But if I like doing it, I'm just going to go and do it. That's what I do all day. So I think it's probably the way you are too, right? I think all of us are. You just do what you love to do, and it doesn't feel like work, so you just do it a lot.
I think one of the pieces of advice, I love that piece of advice, and the other piece of advice that's related to that was your story about moving from the store to doing cookbooks, and basically having a friend say to you that, you know, type A personalities always think they can figure out what to do next while they're running 100 miles an hour, and the truth is people just don't make good decisions that way. I think that's a paraphrasing of the piece of advice.
Actually, somebody later told me, after I'd done it, I remember somebody saying, it's almost like you have to make a cocoon around yourself and pull in and just sort of let yourself get incredibly bored and just figure out, just sort of sort out what you want and what you don't want. I remember actually with another friend and I were doing it at the same time. She had just left an interior design business. And we would sit around and go, well, what do we want our new businesses to look like? And we said, well, one of the things we wanted to have no employees. Having both come from places where I had like 100 employees at the store. I wanted no employees. I just wanted to work with friends. The second one was that, of course, we wanted to make money because you have to have a business like that. The third thing is we wanted to just do something we absolutely loved. And the fourth is that we wanted to be able to drop everything and go to Paris at a moment's notice. And we would like fall on the floor laughing like that business doesn't exist. And that's just what I get to do. So I think you have to have a vision of what, sometimes we have a vision of what physically we want to do, but sometimes you want to have a vision of the space that you want to work in. I mean, do you want to work in an office on your own and be very cerebral? I always want to work in a space that's like a party, you know, where you're just having a good time with people that you love. And so I think sometimes that space is more important than the actual physical thing that you're doing.
On that note, what are some of the places that you really like to visit? I know you love to visit Paris. Are there other places? Where are some of your favorite spaces?
Paris. Where do I love to visit? Well, actually, we just filmed in Napa, which was incredible. We went to vineyards, and we in January, the shows start that we filmed in California. We went to the Ferry Building, which we love, and Napa. We went to vineyards, and we went to St. Helena, I'm sure everybody knows Model Bakery, and the olive oil place. It was so, I love California, and love to go to London, so.
And is there a really memorable meal that you've had in any of those places where it just stands out in your mind as one of the best meals you've ever had, that where you actually have drawn inspiration for the cookbooks?
Oh, there's so many, let me just think. There's a restaurant in Paris that I actually, it's like a special meal, is called L'Atelier, and it's by Joël Robuchon, if anybody ever goes there. And you actually sit at a counter, which is unusual for a restaurant. And one of the things Joël Robuchon believes in is that nothing should have more than three flavors. And so the flavors are really layered in a very simple but very elegant way. And I like that philosophy a lot. That it's not some complicated thing that you have no idea what's on your plate. It's something just absolutely delicious, but perfectly layered.
I think that one of the interesting ideas in that is that sometimes constraint breeds creativity. If you limit yourself to just three flavors, thinking about how to do something interesting with them, or limiting yourself to just a certain set of tools.
Is that true in your business as well?
It is. Like sometimes, you know, if you have just too many different variables, it just makes it impossible, right? Sometimes it's easier to say, okay, what interesting application can we build on a screen that's this size? What interesting application can we build if we only take 8 megs of memory, right? You know, if you start to actually constrain things, that's actually when things get really interesting.
That's absolutely fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah,
that's amazing. As opposed, we keep thinking of making the box we're working in bigger and bigger and bigger, but in fact, sometimes it's good to make it smaller.
A few years ago, I had run into an artist who was a sculptor, but he was a clockmaker. And I asked him, I said, why are all the sculptures clocks?
Yeah.
And he basically made that same observation. He said, it helps me to actually, he's like, I can't figure out what to sculpt. But if I tell myself at the end, it always has to be a working clock.
Wow.
He's like, I find that frees the rest of my imagination to really think about how
elaborate
a clock I can make and what I can make it into. And so I do think that for some people, they find those kinds of constraints really freeing and empowering.
Wow.
And so maybe there's more examples of that in some of the cooking and cookbook work. One of the stories that I really have loved that you've told me over the time is your story of like how many ovens, what's the layout of the kitchen, because you could really have anything you want, especially on the set of the show. But that said, you've also got to relate to people who have one oven and don't have a garlic press and don't have these things. And I think this notion of having a certain, you know, limited set of tools and saying, you know what, I'm only going to have what the people who have the cookbook have. Because it actually helps put you in their space
exactly.
And understand, okay, well, this is what's going to go wrong with this recipe or that recipe.
Every once in a while I get tempted to have like a wood-burning oven or a, you know, this thing that now that Bobby Flay is so obsessed with is an egg. Do you know what this is? It's like a grill, it's an egg, and I think, oh, well, that would be so much fun to have. But I mean, how many people have one? So I try not to have those things. And the truth is everybody thinks, well, you need all this fancy equipment. You need a knife, you need some half-sheet pans, maybe a mixer, a hand mixer is perfectly fine. You don't need a lot of equipment to make a good dinner. So the constraints are good. That's good. That's my new model now. I like that.
So for foolproof, obviously you had to test the recipes in there and make sure they're absolutely bulletproof. How did you test them?
Over and over and over and over and over again. We started talking about this, that I test a recipe sometimes 25 times myself. Until I'm sure it's exactly what I look for. I'm not sure that most people would know the difference between 20 and 25, the number 20 test and number 25, but I do. And so I keep going until it's like that ping, that's exactly what I'm looking for. And then I hand it to my assistant, she tests it, I watch her. But then I do something else, what I call road test it, is I invite people over for dinner and I test it on them. So I might make, you know, like 5 desserts, because I don't know which ones people are gonna go, oh, that, you know, that cheesecake with fresh raspberries on top, everybody wants that one. Or, you know, exactly what people love to eat. So that's my next test. And unfortunately, sometimes it's a dip dinner, so everybody has to eat dips for dinner.
how do we get on the mailing list to be invited to the road test?
You're invited to the dip dinner, Moira.
I will be your road tester any day.
I think we're all in for the dip dinner. We wanted to turn, if we could, if the three of you would indulge us, to taking some questions from the audience.
Sure, love to.
You had marvelous, diverse questions. So because we're on a university campus, many of the questions were they're busy college students, they're about to graduate, they're finally going to have time to cook. And I think that this is something that applies to very busy women who've been activated in their career and suddenly want to take some time out to cook. Should they just make chicken or pasta? They want to know where to begin.
Well, yeah. I think everybody has to know how to make a roast chicken. That's about as simple. And actually, in one of my books, I call it engagement chicken, because it turns out that some women from, I think, Mademoiselle magazine, Glamour magazine, said to me that they call my roast chicken for my first book engagement chicken, because it turns out in the office, So apparently 95% of the time that one of the women makes roast chicken for their fiance, for their boyfriend, they're engaged within 24 hours. So I highly recommend roast
Best
chicken.
Best relationship advice ever.
Now we're going to go into some really deep questions and very important. How do you keep meringue from shrinking and weeping on a limb of meringue pie?
Oh, that's what it does. I mean, first you want to make sure it's whipped properly, and actually you can never make meringue on a humid day. You have to do it on a dry day. Oh. But meringue, I mean, you don't want to refrigerate it. You want to do it and serve it quite quickly. I think if you refrigerate it, it's always going to have that sort of beads of water on the top.
And somebody in the audience is having trouble with their macaroons. They're following your recipe explicitly, but they're running when they bake them. Should they refrigerate before?
That's what they do.
Got that? And what is the success to making light, fluffy matzo balls?
You follow the recipe in Barefoot Contessa parties, and what you do is you whip the egg whites and fold them in. Instead of putting in egg whites as they are, if you whip them and then fold them into the mixture, they're much lighter.
This is a very practical crowd.
Yeah,
out here.
Really.
I
remember being interviewed at the New York Times, and this very important reporter from the Times said, "You know that little thing in the middle of my Cuisinart? It's broken. What should I do?"
I see you more depth.
Okay, I'm ready for that. I'm ready for anything.
We want to know, how do you maintain your composure in the kitchen? You don't curse like a sailor. We don't see you dropping or rattling pans around and throwing your arms up. Is it music? Is it wine? Is it Buddhist teaching?
Are you suggesting I'm drunk when I'm doing this? There was a time I remember on film I was supposed to carve a duck. And if anybody's ever carved a duck, I have to tell you, it's all bones. It's impossible. And there was a word that came out that rhymed with duck. And it was like, but happily we edited it out.
We are relieved. We're relieved to hear that. So was there ever an ingredient, sounds like it might have been the duck, but that you just couldn't work with and you just decided, I'm not going there, an ingredient that just scared you away?
I can't say there's an ingredient that scares me away, but sometimes I'm working on a recipe and it just goes on and on and on. I just, you know, I've tried it 20 times. I just can't get what's in my head. And I just go, okay, that's it, in the trash, move on. So I'll push against something for a long time, and then at some point I just say, it's just not working. And maybe I'll go back 2 years later and try and figure it out. Something like that. Ginger cookies. I was always trying to get, like, I have the perfect ginger cookie in my head, and I couldn't quite get it. And I tried it, I put it away, I tried it again, and eventually I did.
So to follow that, would you indulge us with a story of a dinner plan that didn't go well or right, and a disaster, so to speak?
Never had a disaster.
Okay. All right.
No, I do remember one time I was working on a dessert that didn't come out right, and I just rummaged through my refrigerator, and I was like, I've got to get some kind of a dessert. And I had berries, and I had creme fraiche and vanilla and honey, and I mixed the honey and the vanilla and creme fraiche together and poured it over the berries, and it was like one of my favorite desserts ever. So out of a disaster, sometimes something wonderful comes up.
So now we're really getting into the depthful questions. Is Jeffrey as cute in real life as he appears on television?
Cuter. Oh, there he
and
is.
And what did you leave in the refrigerator for Jeffrey?
What's what?
In the refrigerator for Jeffrey when you're traveling on tour?
Roast chicken. What else?
They're happily married.
So.
What?
I said, you already have the ring if it's the engagement chicken.
I already have the ring. I don't need to make the roast chicken.
And here, is the barn that you built with your new kitchen on TV on the same property as your home?
Yes, it is. Actually, it's one of the pleasures of my life is that my house is literally on the same property with the barn. So I get up in the morning and I walk to work. And Jeffrey likes to, who has to travel 4 hours to go from East Hampton to New Haven, likes to call me and say, how was your commute?
You are a lucky woman. So I want to ask all three of you to do this for me. Would you give us, if you had to have a last meal, what the three courses would be? And Moira, will you start us?
I'm not starting, not it. I'm not. Okay.
I'm starting.
that's a lot of pressure, considering I'm not the one who uses my oven.
Am I starting? Are you starting?
You're starting. Okay.
Oh, Marissa knows this. I love Sauterne, really good Sauterne. So my dream dinner is three courses, each one of which you can eat with Sauterne. So the first one, and I know this is California, it's completely forbidden, but it's foie gras with roasted apples and a glass of Sauterne, which I just adore. and something with lobster, because lobster is fantastic with Sauterne. And then for dessert, my favorite dessert is a French apple tart, which is a very, very thin crust, very thin layers of apples, and a little glass of Sauterne. And a France sea salt caramel afterwards goes with Sauterne as well. What's yours, Marissa?
Oh, wow. I love food, so it's hard for me. But one of the things I really love is I love soup.
Oh, I love soup.
So,
yeah, me too.
I'm a big fan of cream of tomato. So there's a cream of tomato soup at a soup bistro in New York called Creme Andalouse.
Oh.
And I've actually made, it's one of the few things I've made at home where it's got an interesting, it's a tomato soup, but it has rice that gets blended into it. So it's got a kind of thickness to it.
Yeah.
And some vegetables, which is great. So I would have Creme Andalouse, and then I guess I like rich, creamy foods because I also. I like beef stroganoff. That's one of my mom's favorite things to make, and we have it on Christmas. Christmas is my favorite holiday, so there's lots of good memories with beef stroganoff. And truth be told, like, I'm just a total sweet tooth, so picking a favorite dessert is like completely impossible. But there are these little fluffy macaroons that are from my favorite candy shop in Zurich. I got to live there for a summer, and I gained like 15 pounds because I had a scheme where I was buying like a dozen of these macaroons a day, each from different installations of the candy shop around town, so no one would know how many I was actually buying. Because it was just too embarrassing. So the good news is I was Switzerland, so I was hiking like a fiend, so it actually ended up kind of balancing out, but I still gained weight despite all the hiking because of all the Luxembourgerly. That's what they're called.
Like the French are they all the French macaroons that are like,
the French macaroons, but these are like, they're about the size of a quarter and they're super high and puffy. They're made by a little candy shop called Sprungli.
Wow.
And they were just to die for.
I have to make you there's tomato soup in this book that's tomato soup with, instead of rice, it has orzo, which is the same kind of thing, and it has grilled cheese croutons on the top. So that just adds to the tomato soup.
Grilled cheese would be my last lunch.
So you can have both at the same time. And Moira?
Well, I am someone where the higher the fat content and the higher the calorie count, the more I like it. So I will leave that to you to find what is the most caloric, high-fat food. And that will be my last meal. But I'm going to take my question, just be a little bit...
I like that.
I'm going to break the rules and take my last question and ask Ina one question along the last meal. You talked about what your favorite last meal would be. What meal would you eat where it would be your last meal, but not for good reasons? What do you hate? What's the food that you cannot stand that we would never see in your cookbook?
Cilantro.
Thank you.
Cilantro.
Nowhere.
I love how I just did this because I feel like I'm in such a minority. So cilantro.
That's it. Anything else is fair game, not cilantro. I guess fish eyeballs and foam you won't find either, but cilantro.
Fish eyeballs and cilantro. Good.
So if we're ever having a party with you, we know that rule number one, keep the cilantro away.
That's exactly right.
Well, the Bay Area and Dominican University today got a nice endowment. Has a lot to celebrate. Our Giants won, and we would like to know what a great celebratory cocktail rolling into the season would be. And this is our final question tonight, so leave us with something.
Some fabulous cocktail?
It's a fabulous cocktail.
Well, in this book, there are Rossinis, which are wonderful. It's Prosecco with pureed strawberries and a little bit of Grand Marnier. Really easy to make, very festive, very holiday-like. I highly recommend it. Okay, Rossinis for everybody.
Thank you, Moira, Marissa, Ina. All right. Thank you. In your possession, you have a signed copy of her new cookbook, Go Home and Start Cooking. Grilled cheese on that tomato soup. Good night. Thank you.